What is in your way is the way. These hindrances and personal demons we'd all like to get rid of, they are the golden path to freedom from dissatisfaction, stress, and suffering. They seem to be obstacles, but they are liberators in disguise. After I mentioned the first night that the god Indra was said to have these five strengths, the five faculties, the Indriya, that became five powers that enabled Indra to conquer the demons, I sort of got curious, what were those demons? And online I found the following. Many hundreds and thousands of demons, demi-demons, yakshas, rakshasas, man-eaters, and others resisted the armies of King Indra, which even death personified cannot easily overcome. These are some armies he's got. And a long list of demons was given. I'm not familiar with that mythology, so I just decided they were fear, rage, depression, anxiety, sensual pleasure, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt, and you add whatever other demons you'd like to add to the list. So it continues, roaring tumultuously and fearlessly like lions, these invincible demons, all dressed in golden ornaments, gave pain to the demigods. In many moments of practice this week, we've each done battle with our own set of demons, the hindrances, certain experiences, and most importantly, our reactivity to those experiences that inflicts pain on us. Even when our obstacles are sometimes dressed in the golden garments of sensual pleasure, the seeming empowerment of ill will, maybe the ease and like this is okay feeling of sloth and torpor, or the golden guise of energy that actually is restlessness. So we do battle with hundreds and thousands of moments sometimes when we experience stress and suffering. Today's talk will discuss the fifth and perhaps most toxic hindrance, doubt, and along with the fifth and quite powerful faculty, discernment or wisdom. When we do battle with doubt, it is what is in the way of our freedom. Discernment and our old friend confidence or faith or trust are two key faculties that help us defeat doubt. So I'd like to tell you a story about how a toxic demon got in the way and what happened. There's an ancient myth that I heard from Gil years ago that I've always really found helpful. And since my memory is not the greatest on earth, I'm taking the original myth and I'm giving you my own modified interpretation. So bear with me. There was once a very powerful kingdom ruled by a benevolent king. There came a time when the king had to be away from the palace to go to one of the remote regions of his kingdom to take care of people. While he's away, his courtiers noticed that an ugly little troll called a yaksha had hopped up onto his throne. A very clever courtier said, "I'll get it to leave the throne by luring it away with treats, all the luscious things to eat." The yaksha simply hoovered up the treats and grew a little bit larger. One courtier yelled angrily, "Hey, you can't be there!" And to his distress, the yaksha grew a little bit bigger. Another tried to push him off the throne. And in response, the yaksha grew. A fourth said, I'm just going to ignore it, pretend it isn't there. You guys should just pretend it isn't there. It'll go away. And the yaksha grew bigger. One person tried to put the yaksha to sleep with the kingdom's official most boring ever insurance pitch. But the yaksha just grew. And then the next person's like, nah, you've got it all wrong, and blared the loudest, most obnoxious music at the yaksha. And the yaksha responded by growing larger, leaping to the top of the throne, dancing around, sliding down the arm of the throne and doing a backflip, getting back on the throne and being more powerful and larger than ever. The yaksha just didn't seem to want to budge. Someone said, I don't think it matters. And anyway, I can't do anything about it. I just don't have what it takes. Another debated the yaksha with no conclusion, just back and forth, back and forth. The yaksha ate both of them. That was good. So it was even larger and stronger. Pretty soon, some of them were despairing, deciding they needed to give up the kingdom, go elsewhere, rebuild the palace. And the yaksha, in response, got huge and really powerful. So by now, the courtiers were just a little bit disturbed. So they sent a messenger off to find the king. The king came back and laughed and said to the yaksha, "Welcome! It's so great to see you." The yaksha seemed to get a little smaller. "Sit down, have some tea. I really want to talk with you." The yaksha got smaller. We can take as long as you want. I want to hear all about you." Poof! The yaksha disappeared. So what's in the way is the way. Only by directly embracing the hindrance demon can we get to know it well enough to disempower it and for it to disappear. So the hindrance of doubt, in fact, all of the hindrances, are very much like your very own personal set of yakshas. Isn't that great? You can have as many as you want. Maybe there have been some popping up in this hall. And the reason I'm calling out doubt as a very toxic hindrance is that it can cause a person to doubt the practice itself and then give up the practice or give up on themselves, both of which are not going to lead to freedom. It's one of the worst demons to prey on humans, I think. So sometimes we're not clear about how to practice or, you know, what to do next in our meditation. We might have questions. We might be confused. We might waver as we try to meditate in a certain way or practice with a certain practice. In that case, the recommendation is to ask questions, talk to a teacher or teachers, and get the answers you need. Clear up the confusion. So for a number of years in my practice, I had difficulty, a lot of difficulty meditating with the breath as the object of meditation. I just felt like I couldn't do it. And Gil would describe how amazing and wonderful each beautiful breath was. And I thought, this guy must be some kind of freak of nature. Finally, during a practice discussion on a retreat, I told him, I can't tell the difference between this breath and the next breath, something to the effect of this. And he said something like, oh, it's not that you need to compare each breath with each other. It's that you need to renew awareness with each new breath. I'm like, poof. Like, oh, I finally got it. And I've been able to enjoy practicing mindfulness of breathing since then. So that's an example of clearing up a confusion about practice. And that's not what's officially known as the hindrance of doubt. We learn by asking questions. And, you know, it's a very important part of practice to explore, to question, is this the right teacher for me? Find the right teacher. What is this teaching really saying? Experiment with it and learn it. That's not doubt. It's possible sometimes, though, to notice something that feels more like you're thinking, I just don't know. You're practicing. You're like, this just isn't working. And there is doubt there. You start to know what that feels like. And that's a much bigger yaksha, because you're starting to doubt the practice itself. You know, I'm sort of realizing this isn't the perfect Dharma talk. I actually, you know, I had this inspiration earlier today. I wanted to talk about the planet and sort of compare. So I don't know, I think... So that would be doubt in oneself. That's another very ugly yaksha. So, you know, in Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist texts, the yaksha has a dual personality. On the one hand, the yaksha may be an inoffensive nature fairy associated with the woods and mountains, but there's a darker version of the yaksha, which is a kind of ghost that haunts the wilderness and waylays and devours travelers. So similarly, there's this inoffensive, perfectly healthy questioning that's not doubt. And it's important to know about that kind of learning. But the kinds of questions that arise with the hindrance of doubt are not like those questions. They're like an endless debate back and forth without a conclusion, a vacillation maybe. They're more of the nature to resist something without ever resolving it. So neither wanting to commit to yes or no. The indecisive yaksha, the endless debate. And it may be that a person suffering from this kind of doubt has been through life experiences that conditioned a lack of trust in what, you know, what you're told. I'm not going to go with that. I don't know that I believe that. Or a lack of trust in themselves. Or, you know, maybe they've been in situations where they committed to something and it really went south, and commitment itself feels dangerous. So the toxic kind of doubt involves unhelpful rumination, unwholesome, you know, thought after thought, doubts over and over in the mind without conclusion, perhaps. And the contents of the questions may seem okay, but they're being influenced by an emotional state or a conditioned mental state that inhibits coming to anything. Churning, anxiety, confusion, there's something standing in the way. Sometimes people are worried that the practice might completely upend their life. It might alter their primary relationship in a terrible way. They might have to get a completely different job. There might be these big changes that they know they're unprepared for, and so they might fear, you know, going further in the practice. Or doubt can arise by overwhelming yourself with, you know, taking the furthest goal and putting it right in front of you, like liberation now, you know, I've got to have it, instead of taking one step at a time. You know, you can be so perfectionistic that if a meditation doesn't go perfectly, you're thinking, okay, you know, I just don't have it. Or, you know, I've gone to 3 retreats. How come I'm not liberated yet? What is wrong with me? What's wrong with my practice? So that's an example of bringing these really wonderful goals, this wonderful hunger for the ultimate liberation, too close to where you are right now, and expecting yourself, demanding that you're going to be able to do that. So it's really important to know that doubting your own abilities like that is kind of premature. You know, it's really, we have to give the practice plenty of time. It's called the gradual path for a very good reason. And Gil has said something about that that I've also really counted on all these years, that, you know, if you follow the practice, and again, I'm not going to paraphrase him well, but if you follow the practice, you're already living a better life. So, you know, kind of what is there to lose about that? Even if you don't have liberation, you know, next week, you're living a happier, better life. And that's been true for me. Every year, every practice, it gets better and better and happier and happier. So no need to doubt that. We could decide, I'm a bad practitioner because I haven't attained all 8 jhana states. A really bad practitioner. I mean, don't you think so? Like, that's really bad. Or we might feel hopeless because the hindrances arise. They still arise. Wow, I've been practicing fill-in-the-blank years, and the hindrances still arise. If you're getting discouraged like that, it's really important to remember that when you're aware of it, if you see the hindrance, if you see what's going on, you're no longer stuck in it. And that's a step towards freedom. That's the beginning. So something seen is not something stuck. That's the power of the faculty of awareness. Aware of it, you're one step closer to freedom. So as I've said, self-doubt and doubt in the practice are perhaps the most toxic, hugest yakshas. And it's whispering in your ear, or maybe it's yelling in your ear, the practice is too difficult. I don't have what it takes. Or, I shouldn't have come to this retreat. What am I doing here? That used to happen to me for a long time by about Wednesday. I'd be going, what am I doing here? And why, you know, this is not going well enough. I'm just not good at this. As it had kept happening over time, I discovered that by the next day or that afternoon or even the next sitting, what I would do would be I'd give up and I'd go out and walk in the orchard and smell flowers. And then I'd come back to the next sitting and wow, that was, mindfulness was back, awareness was back. And I finally saw the pattern and kind of recognized what was happening was I was over-efforting. I was exerting too much energy, you know, Sunday through Wednesday. And then I'd hit a point where the system was just like, it was too much. And then when I went out in the garden and smelled the flowers, I was backing off on that energy, backing off on efforting. And lo and behold, I'd go, yeah, I'll just try this next sitting. And it was back. So this is an example of several faculties coming together. There was awareness of applying too much energy that finally arose. In contrast to wise effort, which I described the other day, we kind of try to find the balance in energy that we're applying. Confidence grew when I saw again and again that as I dialed back the energy, like I told you, this is like a 19-year project to dial back the energy enough, and take a break and instead come back to a very relaxed persistence, that wise effort restored mindfulness, it restored awareness, and the ability to practice. So this is, you know, with this practice, as mindfulness restored, the mind grew more settled. And actually, there's a little wisdom that started to grow there. What a relief. It really helped. So when you become aware that self-doubt is playing a role or toxic doubt is putting you off practice, there are a number of things you could consider. First, really important, don't compare yourself to anyone else. Really don't do that. You know, how come he has no yakshas and I still have? How did that happen? You know, Maybe it could have something to do with the fact that he's been practicing more than twice as long as I have. So it's no good to compare yourself to someone else. It doesn't work. Each person has a unique path, a unique set of conditions and causes that have led you to this point, and unique way through that path and out of it, you know, towards freedom. So if I became aware of this a number of years ago, if I found myself in that kind of comparison, I would just say, whisper quietly in the mind, comparing mind. And that alone, poof, it kind of released it. So you could try just noting, comparing mind, and knowing that you should just drop it. Not worth it. Another way is to doubt the doubt. So this means questioning the inevitable flaws in the reasoning that go into the thought. For example, how statistically likely is it that I am the only person in this room who has ever had trouble with mindfulness of breathing? Is that, you know, among 44 people, is that really likely? Or it can mean directly telling your mind, that's not true. When your mind coughs up, for example, I'm no good, I'm not good enough. I mean, that's not true of any human being on this planet. You could ask someone who loves you or cares about you, if you're worried about that. Ask them, am I no good? Am I worthless? And just see what they tell you. They probably won't say, yep, you're worthless. If they do say that, leave. Find another relationship. Share a doubt with a teacher who can help you doubt the doubt. So some people are like, doubting the doubt? What the heck are you talking about? So if that's true for you and you have doubt, share it with a teacher. It's kind of a fun thing to doubt doubt. The teacher will help you explore maybe what is perpetuating it, or just help you find a statement that you can make to yourself, like, that's not true, that will help you out of it. I want to acknowledge that some of us have suffering that originated in complex developmental trauma. Our childhood needs were not met. And, you know, lots of different reasons. But when that's the case, there can be doubt that's in the realm of lack of the kind of self, that healthy self that we need in order to do this practice. And this is not the big self that we're trying to overcome with not self. This is just an ordinary sense of self-esteem. And sometimes that is not there. If you've had a difficult childhood with, you know, parents that weren't able to attend to your needs. So it's good to get psychotherapy, counseling, somatic work. A ton of practitioners that I've met have done that, have benefited their practice through that kind of work. So this is discernment, you know, for you, trying things out and seeing what works for you, what will help you. The way the Buddha described the hindrance of doubt and freedom from it is as if you've traveled with your valuables through desolate country, but you've stuck to the path and you made it through and out of the desolate country. You still got your valuables intact. So I think doubt is similar. You know, there could have been a man-eating yaksha, a person-eating yaksha that destroyed you if you veered from the path of practice into doubt, into self-doubt, into doubt in the practice. Could have just undone. And you would leave all the work you did before on practice gone. But that's not what needs to happen. You can stay on the path of practice, work with the teacher, teachers, work with friends who are in the Dharma, talk to them, you know, especially those with more wisdom, and come through intact with all the work you did before, still supporting you. So wisdom or discernment is the fifth of the five spiritual faculties we've been exploring all week, and it supports all the rest of the faculties in conquering the hindrances. Confidence, wise effort, awareness, a settled mind, and all the faculties in our toolkit help us develop this fifth faculty of discernment or wisdom. And this is where we actively differentiate between and take responsibility for the unwholesome mental and bodily actions and the wholesome. There are things we need to relinquish, and we need to be able to identify them in order to have that poof happen. The first form of wisdom we have all manifested already is coming to practice. Like something in you saw, okay, mindfulness practice or meditation or maybe Buddhism, it varied with people, you know, what they're looking for. One of these things is a better way than what I've been struggling with in my life or there's a way to get to my goals. So that's already a form of wisdom. Something found your way to practice here. To me, there seems to be a deep healing impulse in human beings and in the planet. I recently was watching a documentary by David Attenborough that starts and ends with him walking through Chernobyl all these decades after the nuclear meltdown that caused them to desert the entire area. And the whole place is covered with plant life, and animals have started to reappear. The planet is healing itself, even from this human-made disaster. So this healing wisdom in each of our bodies, in the planet, I think it's part of the system. So we cast about looking for a better way to live, something that'll work, and discernment lands us in this practice. And I think most everybody in this room has at least seen some little benefit, or you wouldn't have come to a retreat. You know, that's a little too intense. But, you know, maybe you found just this much, or maybe you found, I mean, some of you have reported really feeling joy, really feeling great, or feeling like, I finally saw it. I saw the ill will. I've been in ill will all this time. Oh, man. Or seeing the sensual pleasure, or seeing any of this. That is a triumph. That's great. That's discernment. That's wisdom taking on. So when I was casting about a couple decades ago, I found my way to a grief support service in Palo Alto to volunteer. I thought I would offer support for families and children going through the kind of difficulty, or even a little different difficulty, that my family went through. And I wanted other families not to have to suffer the way my family did. It was like, let me go do something worthwhile with this pain and misery. And in my years of volunteering there, starting pretty early, I met three people that seemed qualitatively different than anybody else I knew. And I was like, what is it about them? Just three different individuals. And as I listened to them over time, they didn't say that much about it. But, you know, everybody would come back from a break or vacation. They'd say, well, what'd you do on your vacation? And they'd mention, oh, I went to Spirit Rock, or I went to Insight Meditation Center. Oh, I helped Insight Meditation Center build a ramp for their new building. And I was like, what's that? So I got curious enough that I looked up Gil online, and I was like, okay, what's this Insight Meditation Center, and what's, he was a Soto Zen priest. What's Soto Zen? And the definition I found was, you know, the practice of everyday life. And I was like, okay, that's for me. I want to live a better human life. So I started going there. And these people mentioned IMC and Spirit Rock. So January of 2004, I went to IMC, and I sat down for the first talk that Gil gave, and sat for the meditation. So I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know about zafus and zabutons and chairs. I sat on the carpet, and within 10 minutes, I was sweating bullets. I was in so much pain. But I was like, nobody else is moving. I don't think I'm supposed to move. So I didn't move, you know, for 35 minutes. And then Gil gave a Dharma talk, and I got something from it. I was like, okay. And so I started going back every week and taking notes and walking away. And during that week, trying what he had pointed to in the Dharma talk. And I came to finally realize what was different about these three people who all became dear friends is that there was care, there was kindness, there was compassion there, and it felt different. So you may not even know you're different, or maybe your friends and family have told you, like mine did. At first, they thought I had joined a cult, and they were really worried, like, she's going off on these things, and is she going to come back okay, or what's going to happen? And I would come back, and after a few years, my spouse said to me, you know, you come back happier. So I was like, yes. And even my sister, who still is like, I don't know about this Buddhism thing, noticed that, you know, there are things that are happening that are different. And each of you has probably already affected people in your life in that way by being different, you know, just a little bit nicer, just a little bit more settled, whatever it is. We change, and this discernment between the wholesome and the unwholesome happens. So sometimes it happens and we let go of things that we're not even, at first, we're not even really conscious of it. And then we compare notes with our Dharma friends and we're like, you too? Wow. Like most of the people I know, when I first started comparing notes with people, we all realized that we had started eating more vegetarian and vegan food. We no longer were interested in meat and poultry. And we were like, wow, isn't that interesting? It wasn't like, for us, it wasn't religiosity. It wasn't like, it's wrong. It was just, it fell away. And it was like, oh, that's discernment. That's wisdom. Same thing with entertainment. Compared notes with people, and they were like, you know, I used to, every weekend used to be a movie or a concert or this or that, or you, and nobody was doing it anymore. And it wasn't like they didn't enjoy music or they didn't enjoy a good story. It's that, you know, they started to find themselves spending more time with Dharma friends or offering service to others, you know, just spontaneously their spare time activity changed. So maybe you've noticed stuff like that. And it's kind of, sometimes it just surprises you. It's like only when you talk to your Dharma friends do you know that this is discernment or this is wisdom starting to occur. So we keep developing discernment. You know, this week you've developed more discernment. You've developed more wisdom as you've gone along, seeing like, okay, what is the hindrance of ill will? What is the hindrance of sloth and torpor in me if it's here? What is it? And you start to see how suffering is constructed in your experiencing and your reactivity. You start to know your thinking. You're aware you're thinking. And that a set of thoughts is fueling an emotion. Or you tease apart things and you see an emotion from a thought. And you go through it. You recognize, allow, feel, tease apart. You finally see and know that what was in the way or what is in the way is the way through. You're going to go straight through the middle of it. Discernment begins to notice the components of experience that lead away from suffering towards freedom. So we start to notice that maybe our body has been in quite a lot of pain off and on during the week. And we notice, some of us notice that pain is coming from physical and emotional tension. It's not anything organic or in, you know, it's not an injury. It's the way I described the other day, cranking up tension by like, I've got to get this right. The posture, the practice, I've got to get this right. Alternatively, there are those in this room who live with physical pain as a reality, as a result of an injury or a result of a medical condition. And the learning there is a different kind of learning to allow space or work with that, be with that, and have other experiences with our relationship with the mind. Discernment differentiates between what's being received in awareness and our attitude towards it, our relationship with it. So I notice pain, and I notice I was fighting it like crazy. I was resisting it, didn't know it. So another example of that is that as I age, I notice I'm experiencing more arthritis in the joints. Lack of mobility. You know, I get up and it takes me a while to straighten up. I went camping this summer on a retreat, a nature retreat, and crawling out of that tent and getting to my feet was probably a really ugly thing to watch. I'm like on all fours like a bear trying to push myself up to my feet. And, you know, at first my attitude was that I couldn't stand the arthritis and physical therapy has to be the cure for everything. I'd been through rounds and I thought physical therapists were, they walked on water and they were great. And like, I just need another round of physical therapy. And so I went through another round and I was doing, you know, an hour and a half of physical therapy exercises a day for a year. And I was like, it's not getting better. And I finally went for hip x-rays and found that what was there was not going to be improved by exercise. So wisdom arose after a while. You know what? I can stand the discomfort. If I don't sleep at night for two nights in a row, not very well anyway, if I only get 3 hours, by the third night, I am going to sleep, guaranteed. So I started like, okay, you know, there's going to be an increasing, this body is falling apart, and it doesn't matter how great your physical fitness routine is, got to tell you, lift weights, swim, hike, bike, it still hurts. So this is a fact of aging. This is sickness, old age, and death. This is what we practice to prepare for. And I recognize I don't have to be reactive with that. I'm just going to cruise with it. Yeah. It's sensation while I'm lying in bed. But I don't interpret it anymore as like, oh, I can't. So discernment also begins to offer us choice in that way, and choice in our thoughts, our speech, and our actions. We start to commit to the choices that bring more freedom, more relief from suffering. Even after, if we go down the rabbit hole a lot of times after seeing, should I do this? No, I'll do it anyway. It'll feel good. No, it won't. We do that. And then finally the day dawns, and somebody was sharing this with me today, that, oh, it fell away. I was no longer tempted at all. It was so, that was such a nice thing to hear, right? That discernment and wisdom took over. So we start to really get and integrate things on a visceral level. It becomes part of us. It becomes embodied in us, integrated. So ultimately, these actions of discernment and wisdom, bit by bit, let go of our stress, our suffering, our dissatisfaction. Or I should say, it lets go of us. You know, you don't, when it lets go of you, you don't feel like you did anything. It was just like, oh, that isn't there anymore. Isn't that cool? So wisdom becomes integrated and understood, and it's like a veil has been lifted. Like Gil was saying, you clean your glasses. Like all along, things have been a certain way, but there's been so much mud on your glasses that, you know, you were lucky you could see it all. But finally, it's cleared away. And we're able to let go of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness as it happens. This is life. There's unsatisfactoriness. So the moments unfold and experiences letting go of us as it happens. So what's in the way has become the way. And the yakshas can't stand it. They pop out of existence before they gain any power. There's no more throne room for them. Yay. So life becomes the Dharma in us. We change, and the way we relate to reality changes. I think it's already changed. It points towards freedom, and it sort of starts to flourish in that way of living. So I hope this has been helpful to all of you. I wish us all freedom from suffering, freedom from stress, no more ugly little yakshas, or at least we see them like, ah, yaksha, poof, gone. So thank you very much.